Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. President Trump's demand for more than $5 billion for a border wall got him nothing but the longest government shutdown in history. The government opened again on Monday with none of the issues that led to the impasse between Congress and the White House resolved. Both sides continue to work on a resolution, but in just 3 weeks, the government could shut down again because the president insists this time he will not back down. Were there political repercussions for that shutdown? Will there be if it happens again in 3 weeks? Meanwhile, polls indicate the president's popularity is declining as his disapproval ratings rise. But Republicans are still all in for Donald Trump. The RNC is said to be moving quickly to head off a potential primary challenger who could thwart the president's renomination in Charlotte next year. And Democrats are repeating what Republicans did in the lead-up to the last election. All of them appear to be running. Plus, a spoiler entered the contest on 60 Minutes on Sunday night, kinda, when ex-Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz said he is considering a run as an independent. It's all politics, and this hour we look at all things political. Here in our Spirit Square studio is Dr. Scott Huffman, a professor of political science at Winthrop University, where he's also the director of the Center for Public Opinion and Policy Research and of the Winthrop Poll Initiative. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Dr. Michael Bitzer is joining us via, I guess, Skype. He is a professor of politics and history at Catawba College, but he joins us this morning from Davidson College. Welcome. Welcome back.
Good to be with you.
So let's begin with some polling numbers. According to a new Washington Post ABC News poll conducted on January 21st through the 24th, Trump's approval rating stands at just 37%, with 58% of the public disapproving of his job performance. That's up 5% from November. An AP poll has his approval rating at just 34%. I don't know which one of you wants to. You're the polling expert, Dr. Huffman. Put those numbers into some sort of historical context 2 years into a president's first term.
Sure. Historically, there haven't been many folks that have gotten, that low and been reelected, but Ronald Reagan did. His approval ratings did dip down into the 30s, but they're hugely different circumstances. The way we should look at this is more, let's examine Trump's core base, not Trump supporters, Trump's absolute core. These numbers are getting down close to that. I would put Trump's core probably at 30%. So, these are folks that no matter what he does, he could do skeet shooting with kittens on the White House lawn, and they're still absolutely going to support him. But if his approval drops to only his core support, the Republicans in Congress are going to feel very much more freed up to oppose him on policy. And this is because right now they're afraid of, being primaried by, the Trump supporters. And so they showed an amazing fear in the last 2 years of doing anything to oppose Trump because they didn't want to be called out publicly. They didn't want to be dragged down. But to the degree that it gets only down to his core supporters that they couldn't win over without him anyway, that'll free them up a little bit. The folks who are Trump voters, on the other hand, some are strong conservatives, some are just anti-Democrats, and then you've got that core 30% who are just the Trump faithful.
So Michael Bitzer, I think it was President Reagan who was nicknamed the Teflon president because nothing mm-hmm. seemed to stick. Absolutely nothing seems to stick to Donald Trump. He seems to be able to get out of almost any situation that would have torpedoed a candidacy and certainly ended a presidency, or at least caused some severe consequences during that presidency. That doesn't seem to be happening to Donald Trump. So when his approval ratings dip to this low, people say, well, he's close to not being able to be reelected. Are they right? Or something, can he pull a rabbit out of his hat?
Well, we've got a long way to go. I mean, we've got almost 2 years before the November election. I think this is symptomatic. And what Scott said is absolutely core to understanding today's politics. I would only add that I think this symbolizes the kind of polarized partisanship that we see, that, you know, Democrats are going to absolutely oppose the president. It doesn't matter who that Republican president is, they are going to be against them. Republicans are going to be party loyalist. It's the independents, if there are any true independents out there, that may lean one way or the other. But, you know, for this kind of an environment, as Scott said, you know, the base is still with him. Now, the question is, can he rally that base that helped him to get over in a few key states in 2016, the Pennsylvanias, the Wisconsins, the Michigans? Can he rally that same kind of anger and energy that propelled him into the presidency in 2020? We're going to have to wait and see, but I think the numbers are indicative of where we are as a polarized country.
So, Michael, you teach political history, and there are a lot of people alive today listening to this program who have no memory, no personal memory of a time when there was partisanship in Congress and partisanship between the resident at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue and the people up on Capitol Hill. When did this start, that Democrats would automatically oppose anything a Republican president wanted to do, and Republicans would oppose anything a Democratic president wanted to do? When did that start? It didn't used to be this way.
No, and I'm actually teaching a course on polarization in American politics, and we just covered, you know, a couple of different scholars' arguments. I think what has happened is you have to go back in time and understand that the parties were not like what we see today. When I describe the Democrats of the 1940s and the 1950s, I have to remind my students that there were such things called Southern conservative Democrats, that they were typically more aligned with Republicans than they were naturally with their own party. But there were also things called liberal Northeastern Rockefeller Republicans who were socially liberal, that might be more aligned with the Democratic Party today. In the 1980s into the 1990s, with the realignment of the South, going from the solid Democratic South to almost a solid Republican South at the presidential level, the parties have basically sorted themselves into like-mindedness. They're very much homogeneous in terms of their ideological perspectives, and that's when you start to see this intense polarization of, I'm not going to vote for my party sometimes, I'm going to vote against the other party.
Does that make the country ungovernable?
At this point, yes. I mean, it's our system is naturally designed to create conflict. And when the two parties, this government shutdown, the longest in history, I would argue is a prime example of that. But you have to be willing to compromise. And there aren't a whole lot of people in either party willing to say, you know what, I'll take 50, 60% of what I can get. If I have to give up something for the other side to get something, now it's, I want 100% or I'm not going to give anything.
So I want to go back to something that Scott Huffman said a minute ago about the solid support of the president by the Senate and by members, because the Senate is controlled by Republicans, but by other Republican office holders. And they don't want to oppose him on policy because they're afraid of what their voter reaction might be. But yesterday, every security chief in the country testified before the Senate, and every one of them took issue with almost everything the president has said about national security, about where the dangers lie in national security. And it is said by reporters that this has some Republicans a little concerned about what position they should take on this. Do they go with the president, who seems to be making up this out of whole cloth, or with people who have dedicated their lives to studying what's going on in the rest of the world and as it pertains to our national security? Will this be the breaking point?
It for some of them, yes. The ones who think to themselves, I am deeply afraid of Trump's core base. No matter what it dwindles down to, they are going to stay with the president, which is hard to do, by the way. Remember, it was the Republican Senate that passed a clean resolution before the government shutdown, and then refused to pass the exact same bill afterwards because the president had changed his mind. Now, the way out of this is they're going to hope that they can listen to these experts, say these are the things we need to do to beef up security. It does not involve a 2,000-mile wall. It does not involve even 200 miles of wall, but there's border security in it. Trump can tell his base, I won. Because I got border security. It was a metaphorical wall anyway,
shouldn't particularly these career Republicans like Lindsey Graham and the head of the Senate, McConnell. They've been around a long time. And when the president is told by all these security people that the least important feature of our national security infrastructure would be a wall, we have much more serious concerns over North Korea, about the coming together on policy of China and Russia, stronger than it even was during the Soviet Union era, threats from ISIS, threats from the Taliban, all things he wants to dismiss. At what point does it become political suicide for them? Because if one thing goes wrong in those areas, for them to support a wall as opposed to beefing up security elsewhere, at what point does it become political suicide for them?
It doesn't. And here's why. As you pointed out, they've been in it so long. And one of the reasons they've been in it so long is not defying the party sentiment of the time. You got to remember, even on things like a cap and trade, right, to deal with, CO2 emissions and greenhouse gases, that was originally a core Republican idea that they wanted, hey, we can use capitalism as a way to cut down on pollution. Then all of a sudden, some conservative base turned against it, and all of them immediately flipped. And so it used to be that when George W. Bush, just like George H.W. Bush, just like Ronald Reagan, said we need to give amnesty to some people here and then we need to have a guest worker program to fulfill jobs, Graham was like all for it then, but then he started being called Grahamnesty by his base and all of a sudden he flipped. So it's not political suicide for him to take something, take a position on something, and then it go wrong because Americans have a very fickle memory. And as long as he can switch, he'll be fine. And the evidence of that is he went from a 51% approval rating among Republicans in South Carolina to a 72% approval ratings among Republicans in South Carolina just for yelling at Brett Kavanaugh's accuser.
So in the 90 seconds we have remaining, Michael Bitcher, put your historian cap back on and tell me if this is normal behavior for a government and in a political environment. Is this particular to the United States? Is it particular to the United States today, but not 50 years ago? Is it particular to Western democracies around the world? This staunch support for and flip-flopping on every issue if it's politically expedient.
So I have about 15 seconds left.
That's right. You have exactly right.
The answer is no, but I would also point that the president has sent out tweets saying the intelligence people seem to be extremely passive and naive when it comes to the dangers of Iran. They are wrong. We have the president throwing his own national security experts under the bus.
And where does he get that information?
I have no idea.
Well, shouldn't that concern people? We have no idea where the president is getting his point of view. Shouldn't that, if it's not coming from the people who we pay to study this for their lives, and we don't know where he's getting it, should that not concern people?
The president would say he's the smartest person in the room. I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. When we come back, we'll talk about the government shutdown, which was the dumbest thing that's ever happened in some of people's opinions. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're sitting here talking politics of the moment, because it changes every other moment, with Dr. Scott Hoffman from Winthrop University and Dr. Michael Bitzer from Catawba College. So, people on the left believed that the president caved last Friday when he announced the government would reopen this past Monday. Even some key people on the right, like Ann Coulter, accused him of being a wimp. Fox Business News host Lou Dobbs said Nancy Pelosi, quote, just whipped the president of the United States. So if he lost in this, and some people would say he didn't, were there any winners in this shutdown?
Well, Nancy Pelosi was a winner, not just because, you know, in the end she didn't have to cave in, but she legitimized herself further among the Democratic base. Remember, there were a lot of people saying, hey, I'm not going to support Nancy Pelosi to be speaker, you know, among her own Democratic cohort in the House. We need somebody younger. We need a different Democrat to be Speaker of the House. So she had to throw her weight around to get chosen again as Speaker of the House. This justified that among her base. And I'm talking about her base in Congress, mm-hmm. right? The other Democrats in the House of Representatives. So the folks that said, you know, she's not up to challenging Trump, we need a younger person, to them, she can now say, this is why I'm Speaker. And she's punishing a few of those. You know, don't forget,
right.
She's stripped key assignments. But she was a winner, not just because in the end she didn't cave, but because the Democrats in the House now have to say, yeah, she's tough enough.
So last Friday seemed to be kind of a perfect storm, if such a thing exists in this, because LaGuardia Airport reported slowdowns and the traffic control system said we can't keep this up much longer, and air traffic was backing up, and that you knew that was going to have some impact on the shutdown, because we're talking people's lives, and we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars that the airlines were losing, et cetera, if that continued. So was it that? Was it public pressure? Was it falling poll numbers? Why did the president decide to reopen the government? What was the cause, Michael?
I think it was all of the above. I mean, you also have to remember there was a massive amount of news coverage about government workers who were struggling to put food on their table, who were having to go potentially to food banks. You know, one thing that I think was really evident, but maybe didn't get as much media coverage, was the FBI director came out and said, this is unacceptable.
Right.
To have people who are federal agents having to work without pay, potentially for a third paycheck to go by, I think just really, as you said, everything came together in a perfect storm. With the poll numbers shrinking, the president had to find some way out. And, you know, he's going to continue to demand the wall. The question is, will Congress, both the Republicans and the Democrats, accede to it? That, you know, is a policy initiative that is not very popular among the general public as a whole, except, again, as Scott has mentioned, for his base.
Well, and apparently not popular for Republicans. They control both houses of Congress and the White House for 2 years and never took any action on this wall. Why now?
Well, and that's often the things you run on, you don't actually care about. You just convince the public that you care about it.
But why now? Why is he grabbing onto this issue?
It's all Obama and health care and this. You know, it sputtered for so long before. And so now, again, it's all about ginning up the base. This worked for him in the campaign, mm-hmm. right? This got people fired up. The people who said, you know, who were saying, oh, we need to be made safe, and they were also secretly saying we're afraid of a changing America. This wall, it was both metaphorical and literal to them, and that they wanted to keep the immigrants out.
Yes,
and
but so, why now?
Because it worked before. And so he saw a success then that got him to the White House, and I think he saw it as a success now, and he was basically teased into it by people like Ann Coulter and other folks, and he can't take that.
So he's been backed into a corner, so he had to open the government. The government's only open for 3 weeks. It seems unlikely, I could be wrong, that Nancy Pelosi will say, you know, this time we're going to give you your $5 million for your wall. I don't think she's going to do that. So in 3 weeks, are we going to have a repeat of this? And if so, who gets the blame? He accepted the blame in the Oval Office with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi the first time.
5 days later, he said that it was the Democrats' fault.
And he's already said, if the government closes in 3 weeks, the Democrats own it. Is that how the public's going to see it?
What I think will happen is some type of border security will come out. There will be, Nancy Pelosi will do her darndest to keep any actual wall out of it, but he'll say, I insisted on border security for, you know, my base and for America's, and I got border security, and he'll call it a win and move on to the next kafefi.
So you're saying that he will settle for something less than the wall.
And his base will take that as a win. He'll say, I was playing them all along.
Wait, will Ann Coulter take it? Will Lou Dobbs, who've already been critical of him, take it?
Absolutely not.
Will Rush Limbaugh take it?
Nope. But
won't they have the ear of the base? Won't they fire up the base and call him a wimp they did before?
The broader Republican conservative voting base, but his core base... Not necessarily. And he has been reduced to his core base right now and thinks he can rebuild on that.
So the president has said if he doesn't, and this may be his out, Michael, he has said that if he doesn't get the funding from Congress for this wall, he can declare a state of emergency. And there's some question about whether you can legitimately claim an emergency at the border, given the length of time it has taken to get to the point where you would declare a state of emergency. But let's just say he does it. Bruce Ackerman, who's a law professor at Yale, wrote in the New York Times that he cannot declare an emergency at the border. He says that would be illegal and would force the armed forces, who would be tasked with carrying out his orders, to choose between abiding by the commander-in-chief's wishes and committing a federal crime. We've already deployed troops to the border. So what makes this illegal?
I think that it is certainly an argument and a battle over presidential power. And we have tended to see, as Congress becomes more polarized and there's gridlock within the institution of Congress, what we tend to see is more recent presidents choose to do things on their own, to go through executive authority, executive power, and be able to do things that normally would have required congressional assent. They're now using things like commander-in-chief powers to say, I have this authority. Now, the question is, will someone challenge, if the president declares a national emergency, someone will challenge that, and it will be up to judges to make the decision, well, if it was such a national emergency when you started talking about these, you know, threats of invasion, why didn't you do it, you know, several months ago when you were making the claim leading up to the midterm elections? Why did you wait a few months later to finally say, okay, now we have a national emergency? I don't know where that will end up. But
there's two streams there, right? So like... you said the deployment of troops already there, but they're not violating posse comitatus because they were just supposedly doing backup stuff.
And posse comitatus is?
Using military police action within the United States. Right. So the other stream is, and this is what Michael's talking about, is when it goes to court about whether or not it's a legitimate emergency. Now, the last thing is he could declare an emergency, not use troops directly, but take money from the Department of Defense and spend it on what he wants without using the actual troops. Of course, he'd be denying Department of Defense their funds, but he would not be violating posse comitatus. It would still go straight to the courts. Yeah, I mean, almost instantaneously.
So you talked about the use of commander-in-chief powers because of this impasse that we have politically in the country. And one of the other demonstrations of political impasse are these constant government shutdowns or threats of shutting down the government. When did that start and why? This is over the budget. It's over continuing resolutions to fund the government. Why can't we have a budget that passes and lasts for the duration of a normal budget?
Debt ceiling.
Debt ceiling.
The debt ceiling. And, businessmen of true billionaire types have said for decades, the debt ceiling is absolutely stupid. You don't run a business that way. If the business needs to borrow money to continue to go, you find a way to be profitable. But, you know, the true deficit and debt hawks are like, no, we can't get rid of it. You know, it limits on how much the U.S. can borrow. So when we've reached that point, we can't borrow anymore, so we don't have enough money to pass the existing budget. But if we got rid of the debt ceiling and passed a law, and this has been proposed in the past couple of weeks, passed a law that said if we can't come to a budget, we continue at last year's funding levels until we can, it would prevent shutdowns. Those are two things we could do to prevent shutdowns.
And to quote the old song, how long has this been going on, Michael?
Well, I mean, it goes back to the 1980s, really with the advent of Congress reasserting itself over the budget and the president's, you know, thinking at the time Nixon's ability to impound funds that were appropriated, and Congress said, no, we appropriated that money, we need you to spend it. It really kind of blew up from there. Reagan, I believe, had three government shutdowns. It's happened in the 90s. It certainly happened in 2013. But this was, you know, emblematic of the divide between the two, because for so many weeks, neither side was talking to each other. That's the thing that I think is truly astounding with this one, was there was no effort early on to make any kind of an attempt of, hey, can we at least come together and have some kind of conversation about what you want? We know what you want. We know what we want. But nobody was willing to talk to each other.
Yeah.
You know, there's a great book chapter in a book called Showdown at Gucci Gulch, and it's about these issues in the 80s. Yep. Gucci Gulch was, you know, where all the lobbyists hung out to grab congressmen and try and get their ear, about the tax reform of 1986. And if I am not mistaken, the chapter is titled The Three-Pitcher Lunch, where they sat down at a bar in D.C., three pitchers of beer, Democrats and Republicans, and hashed out their differences, hammered out their differences over this tax bill. We are not going to see that today.
Well, you know, I have not read The Art of the Deal, but I'll bet you there is something in there about a negotiation. And I have taken a class on negotiation, actually. And one of the things they tell you is that one of the tactics is knowing what you will do and what you will not do in the course of negotiation. You have to be willing to walk away. Apparently, the president was. Chuck Schumer said that at one meeting at the White House, he said, I'm not getting the wall. He banged on the table. He got up and left. Mm-hmm. And Pelosi said, I'm not budging. There's no money for the wall. So they've decided on both sides that we'll just walk away from this. Well, when you've got that on both sides, where do you go?
That is the great question. I think, you know, what's going to be interesting in my mind is this conference committee, something that is typically a normal part of congressional operations, but over the past couple of years, we have never seen it, where members of the House and members of the Senate come together and actually try and find out a compromise, find a solution to this issue. It would be interesting to see how far they get, and then what the White House's reaction is going to be once we start to hear about what they're thinking. And again, as we've noted, what the Ann Coulters, what the Rush Limbaughs decide is acceptable and what isn't. You know, will that prolong and potentially avoid the next government shutdown? Who knows?
And Michael, you correct me if I'm wrong. I think this conference committee is not leadership. It is actually people on the core committees,
the
appropriations. Yeah. And so they have a better chance. It's still a roll of the dice.
So whatever happens in the moment, we live from crisis to crisis in this country now, and it's driven largely by the news cycle, one presumes. But in 2 years, on Election Day, are people going to remember the government shutdown? What are they going to remember? The shutdown, the building of a wall, the not building of a wall, the failure to repeal and replace Obamacare, the results of the Mueller investigation, or something else that we can't even imagine at this time in our lives? What will they remember? What will influence a political decision on election
day. I would say the odds are something that we can't imagine right now with a little bit of the other stuff being thrown in. The ads against Trump in 2020 are sure it's going to, you know, mention the shutdown. It's something, if something explosive comes out of the Mueller investigation, that just upends everything. But a lot of those ads are fundamentally just giving people justification for how they were going to vote anyway. So if, you know, Kamala Harris is the nominee, we've already seen this birther stuff start up about her. So if she's the nominee, depending on if Cory Booker or, you know, whomever else becomes the nominee, we don't know what's going to come out of the Mueller investigation. All of these things together usually just serve to justify how you're going to vote anyway or turn people off. And so, you know, and I know we're going to get to this probably in the final segment, but turning people off to depress turnout, which actually worked, and to depress some Democratic turnout, especially African-American Democratic turnout for Hillary Clinton in a couple of key states, as well as, is there going to be a spoiler? There are not that many people who are truly centrist. So, the Starbucks CEO is not going to get
the votes he wants. But the other spoiler could be Russia or China or both, because we have done nothing, as far as I know, to impede their ability to do what they did last time and perhaps this time in spades, because they will have learned their weaknesses and their strengths.
Not just what they did before. We have also seen an increase in direct attempts at trying to get into state-level election commissions.
So why isn't that the crisis that we're fighting and closing the government over? Why isn't that the crisis? That seems to be fundamental to the future of the country. Michael.
The intelligence officers all said that exact same thing before Congress, and the president has chosen not to put that as a priority.
Well, what about the Congress? Why aren't they making it a priority?
Well, they certainly have the power to appropriate funds, and when they decide to spend money, they can issue orders with that money to say, you will do this.
I mean, they don't even have to elect Donald Trump or another candidate of their choice to make this a problem for the country. All they have to do is sow the seeds of distrust in the process.
Sure, but the reason we're not addressing it is because it's far more interesting to the average consumer of media to talk about whether or not the president served cheeseburgers to a national football champion, whose name I won't mention because of Michael.
He's mentioning Clemson.
Anyway, so that gets far more attention. People would love to chat about that. People do not want to talk about cybersecurity. They don't understand it. It doesn't make fun
Facebook
arguments.
What's to understand? It's completely understandable. It's completely understandable.
I mean, only that we
that
need security.
Or we're too dumb to be governable. Seriously. I mean, it's completely understandable. We have to take a break, and I have to get off my soapbox. We're going to come back with Dr. Scott Huffman and Dr. Michael Bitzer in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking politics of the day with Dr. Michael Bitzer, who is a political scientist and professor of history and political science at Catawba College. He joins us via Skype from Davidson at the moment, Davidson College. Dr. Scott Huffman is here, political scientist and director of the Center for Public Opinion and Policy Research at Winthrop University. The Mueller probe may or may not turn up anything that affects the election or affects the integrity of the office of the president at the moment, but in advance of the Mueller report being released, the Republican National Committee, I believe, voted last week to throw the party's undivided support to President Trump and what they described as, quote, his effective presidency. This event evidently is unusual because historically the Republican National Committee has refrained from expressing support for a candidate before he officially becomes the party's candidate. But really, is it that unusual? He's an incumbent president of a political party. Why wouldn't they throw their support to him?
Reagan was, trying to essentially campaign against Gerald Ford when Gerald Ford was the sitting president. I mean,
Ted Kennedy versus Jimmy Carter.
Yeah, very strongly. And of course, Kennedy ended up, getting a platform to, rail against Carter at the convention because of it. So it is uncommon, but the idea is the protection of the party. And, there's two ways to look at it. Either Trump's going to tear the party apart, or the party might disintegrate if they don't support Trump. So the only thing that they can do is hang on to him. The interesting thing is, of course, Trump accused the Democratic Party of basically putting their thumb on the scale for Hillary Clinton against Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primary and saying, you're denying the people, fair say. And, they weren't inherently wrong. But, when it's on their side, they're terrified for their party.
But isn't there a difference when your party holds the office?
When you're an incumbent?
Yeah.
We just gave you two examples. Of
All right.
Yeah.
All right. So the Republicans are also, I understand, considering maybe they've already done it. Trying to limit competition for the president by canceling all of their primaries, so he won't have a challenger.
It has been talked about very strongly in South Carolina among the Republican Party. We are the first in the South, so it would set off. So, I'm hoping not, because that just makes it so fun, even if there's really no competition. But we are going to have the Democratic primary, which is going to be a circus in and of itself.
But is canceling your primaries, it seems to me, would be limiting your airtime. Because you're not going to get the kind of coverage that the Democrats are going to get with their gazillion candidates. And it seems to me the president thrives at campaign rallies.
Well, he loves that, his rallies. But here's what would happen if you have a primary, right? All primaries are people of the same party saying why other people in the same party are truly horrible.
Right.
So if you let the Democrats duke it out saying why all the other Democrats are horrible, but you don't have anybody saying that about you, it actually inoculates you a little bit.
South Carolina Republican Party Chairman Drew McKissick asked, why have taxpayers pay for a primary? Our party totally supports the president. So it's probably not going to happen in South Carolina, right?
It's looking that way. It's not decided yet, but he's certainly setting up an expectation that it could be canceled.
Of course, that's 2 years away.
Exactly.
Although, when do they have to make the final decision? Because if the Mueller investigation comes out with something detrimental to the president, they would want primaries, it would seem to me, right?
And that's not that difficult. The things are going to already be in works for the Democratic primary. Basically, the state Republican Party would just have to kick its usual primary apparatus into gear. You could probably do that with 6-8 months advance notice.
And former Republican Senator Jeff Flake announced that he will not launch a campaign against Trump in 2020. He said, I've always said that I do hope that there is a Republican who challenges the president in the primary. I still hope that somebody does, but that somebody will not be me. Why do you suppose he said that? Just doesn't want to get into it, or are there other factors at play here?
Well, I think the likelihood is, even if somebody does challenge the president, it's the Trump party now. The Republicans are fully behind the president.
Okay.
Nobody is really going to move that needle, I think, in the next couple of years, unless something epically happens. And even then, it's unlikely. There's talk about Governor Hogan from Maryland, who's a very popular Republican governor, potentially. There's always been talk about John Kasich, the former governor of Ohio. But, this is Trump's Republican Party, and the Republican Party is Trump. And that's where things are, I think, for the inevitable future of the next 2 years.
So campaign manager, former campaign manager Paul Manafort has been indicted and is awaiting sentencing. The president's former lawyer, Michael Cohen, is going to jail. Longtime Trump political advisor Roger Stone was indicted and arrested this week, not in that order. The president's former White House National Security Advisor, Michael Flynn, is awaiting sentencing. Whether or not the president was involved in or even knew about collusion with the Russians, even if he never charged with obstruction of justice, what about the optics of all this? Are people just going to, his core supporters are certainly going to be blind to this and just dismiss it as a witch hunt. But what about people who are on the fence, or Republicans who are more traditional, who worry about the future of their party? Should any of this come
Yeah, absolutely. Mainly because it'll do a lot of things. It's going to fire up the Democratic base. It could depress Republican turnout. People, these are the people who are just like, my God, I'm not even going to bother showing up and voting. So they should be concerned about it. It could absolutely affect the turnout in 2020, and that could have a massive effect, not only in potentially putting in a Democratic president, but in making the House majority even larger and maybe even turning the Senate. So absolutely, core Republicans are terrified about the impact this could have more broadly.
So what has to happen in the next 2 years? It would seem to me that to elect anybody, particularly at the presidential level, the party or the candidate has to have a positive image or a good track record, or you have to resort to scare tactics, one would presume. What is the Republican message, Michael, going forward for the next 2 years?
I think, again, it's going to be a focus on the base to say that, look at all the great economic growth, even though that was there before Trump was sworn in. The economy seems to be doing well, government shutdowns and $11 billion otherwise. The question is, in my mind, do we hit the natural business cycle of a potential recession? And if that happens, I think then all bets are off. In my broader mind, the question becomes, with the demographic shift that we're inevitably going to see in 2020, are we starting to see the end of the Reagan coalition? We go through these cycles of presidential eras, and it's about 40 years, and we're at that tipping point. And the question becomes, is Donald Trump, in my mind, theoretically, like Jimmy Carter with the end of the New Deal era? And do we see the country shift from in a pendulum-like swing from a center-right to a center-left, with millennials and now Gen Zs becoming the plurality of voters?
Are we seeing that in the Congress, particularly in the House right now?
We are. We're seeing, the younger folks who are getting elected right now to Congress tend to be more, they're labeled progressive, but they're really center left. They're not that far left, honestly. When they're calling for things that are called socialist Medicare for all, these are things that other great capitalist countries in the West have. So they're really not as far left as we think, but there is that movement. And as Michael points out, every single election, the millennials get, bigger and bigger than the boomers, who are the last holdouts of that Reagan coalition that he's talking about. And they get greater and greater earning potential, but not the actual earning. And that makes them matter. And they will begin to turn out. So the shift is coming.
So that's happening on the Democratic side of the aisle.
That's happening on both sides.
Okay. So let's talk about the Democrats for a second before we run out of time here. Senator Elizabeth Warren, Senator Kamala Harris, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, Hawaii's 2nd District Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, former mayor of San Antonio and former Obama cabinet member Julian Castro, and South Bend, Indiana Mayor Peter Buttigieg, I think that's how you say his name, or close to it, have all announced their intention to run for the Democratic nomination. Bernie Sanders is said to be considering a run, as is former Vice President Joe Biden. Senator Cory Booker has got to be thinking hard about it right now. And unofficially, I've heard rumors about Hillary Clinton saying, if Bernie runs, I'm going to do it too. Is this normally when people start jumping in? Right now.
Yes. And what you saw last year were all of those candidates going around and campaigning for congressional candidates, trying to get them elected. And guess what? This year they're turning around and saying, remember when I came and stumped for you? Yeah. Guess what? Now it's my turn to ask for your support, and you stumped for me.
Where were a lot of these folks on this past Martin Luther King Jr. Day?
In Iowa.
In South Carolina,
that's right. Excuse me.
Democratic side. Remember, there's only 3% of the Iowa electorate that I think is African American, whereas it is the core constituent of the Democratic primary. So they are already all, we've got a Yankee parade down in South Carolina.
So as much fun as you guys have watching these primary debates among candidates, I must say that I think the average person probably got Republican fatigue last time around with all these people up on the stage. The stage, you couldn't find a stage big enough to accommodate, or a format that could accommodate a comment from everybody on the stage in the course of 2 hours.
And that lent itself to Trump when there are so many people, because he had the personality to.
We have a similar situation developing here with Democrats. Who does that benefit on the Democratic side?
The biggest show person, whoever the biggest showman or showwoman is, and, you know, Bernie's hair, it's whoever can get the best quote until it narrows down.
What can Democrats, what can the media learn from what happened last time with the Republican primaries and how they dealt with debates for the Democrats? What can they learn?
I'll say the same thing that Michael and I have said, and every political scientist has said for years, and it's going to be ignored because, frankly, we don't know how to do it either. But stop covering it like a horse race.
Yep.
You know, that just puts the showiest person on front of the news instead of anything of substance. I'm not sure how they can continue to be profitable and not do that. But the worst thing you can do is to simply cover the early things like a horse race, who's ahead, who's behind, without any substance whatsoever.
Michael?
I interrupted Michael. I'm sorry.
No, I was completely going to say the show horse mentality, the horse race mentality that the media focuses in on, really, for this Democratic primary, there are going to be fundamental policy issues. You heard Senator Harris talk about Medicare for all. I mean, we are going to be talking about some fundamental core policy issues that need to have the full light of day, that need to have the full exposure, that need to have the kind of challenges and debates going on. But, you know, if it boils down to a 30-second soundbite of attacking one person over the other, you know, we're going to get 2016 all over again.
Not so, a puppet. You're a puppet.
So given what you just said, I can't ask my next question, which was, at the moment, is there a Democratic front runner?
Well, you know, and I think Michael pointed out, you know, Kamala Harris is being talked about a lot, but that once the progressive base gets a hold of her record as a prosecutor, she's going to face challenges on her own.
Well,
so no, there's nobody.
Well, because at the moment, Democrats,
it's all name recognition right now.
Right, 9% Joe Biden leads the pack. 9%, 8% Kamala Harris. Then it drops to 4% for Bernie, 4% for Trump among Democrats, 3% Beto O'Rourke, 2% Michelle Obama, 2% Elizabeth Warren. Given that, should Elizabeth just drop the microphone and walk off the stage?
Of course not. It's only name recognition at this point.
Okay. Yeah. So on Sunday night on 60 Minutes, former Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz said he is seriously considering running for president as a centrist independent. No independent has ever won. I'm not sure, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that under our system, an independent actually can win. So what they generally do is siphon off votes from one party or the other, sometimes hurting a viable Democrat or a viable Republican. If you're smart, and if you're serious about running, can you run as an independent, or should you know you can't win and become a Democrat or become a Republican and run that way?
I think you should indulge your billionaire ego and run because you have people.
But you're hurting the Republic.
But they don't. That's not how they understand. First off, they have people telling them, saying, you are the solution. And none of them understand Duverger's law, why we're only two parties. None of them understand that if they are a true spoiler and nobody gets a majority in the Electoral College, it goes to the House of Representatives, where the party is not going to support an independent.
So
yes, they will only ever be a spoiler.
So Schultz told Scott Pelley on Sunday night on 60 Minutes that more and more people are disgusted with both parties, he's probably right, and are declaring themselves to be independent and therefore could more easily align with an independent candidate. Michael, isn't that faulty thinking? Just because you are an independent doesn't mean that you will vote for an independent. It just means that you're going to make a decision of the two mainline parties, right?
And guess what? If you're an independent, but you say, you know what, I kind of lean to the Democrats or I lean to the Republicans, you vote just as much for that party as the strong partisans do. Less than 10% of people are true independents. They split their votes nearly evenly. And guess what? Those people don't typically tend to show up. The partisans do.
Okay. We're going to be going in-depth on the Democratic presidential race on Monday. South Carolina's Democratic Party chairman will be one of our guests on Monday. So this conversation We're going to be continuing this conversation for two more years. What the heck? Why lie about it? Dr. Scott Hoffman is here. He's a political scientist with Winthrop University. Dr. Michael Bitzer joins us, political scientist from Catawba College. Thank you both for the hour. I know you'll be back soon. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.